April the 12th, 2011. I'm Steve Gerwick, the webmaster of Gerwick.net, and at this time it's a pleasure to welcome a former WWE, I should say WWF, I don't want to get in trouble, but a former WWE or WWF manager, also a former booker with TNA Wrestling, and author. Today I give you Dutch Mantel, Dirty Dutch Mantel. How you doing, my friend?
Steve, good to be here. How's the weather there?
I can't complain, and usually when I complain, it doesn't do me much good anyways.
No, it won't change the weather, so.
And how's the weather?
Well, I guess you want to talk some wrestling now, right?
Well, you know, I know wrestling's becoming kind of a dirty word nowadays, but let's talk some wrestling. What do you say?
Let's do it.
Okay.
And I want you to know that everything I say is 100% true, except for the lies that I may stick in.
I expect nothing less from you, Dutch. Well, first thing right off the bat, you have a second book out, and already an accomplished author. Tell us about the first book, and then obviously the follow-up. How did this come to be, and how's the book sales going?
Oh, they're good. Everything's good. Well, I'd always wanted all these wrestling books coming out, and people said, "Why don't you write a book?" I said, "I don't want to write a book. I mean, what am I going to write about? I don't know." To me. Hey, if I'm going to read, and my books aren't autobiographies, what my books are is a collection or a compilation of stories or events or happenings that occurred to me, directly to me, or to other close, friends of mine or people in the wrestling business. And the first book was called The World According to Dutch, for lack of a better name. I had a website called The World According to Dutch. And it's really a blog, and I started writing it in 2009. So some people wrote me, said, "Why don't you write a book again?" I said, "I will write a book." And finally they kept on. I said, "Well, okay, I'm going to see if I can do it." And then I finally took all these stories that I had, and I'd had these stories in my head forever. A lot of stories where I just heard these old wrestling stories from years ago. And I would learn them in the back seat of a car. This is when we used to drive to towns. That era is gone. And that's where I learned about the wrestling business. I wouldn't sit in the back of the car. I'd actually be driving. And the veterans would be over there drinking beer on the way back. And I was like a designated driver. But in return for my driving, they would tell me these stories. And also they would mentor me on what to do and what not to do in the ring. So to me, that was actually how I really learned the wrestling business. That's how my school started. My school didn't start till 11 o'clock at night. So I would get in the car and the guy would get him, we'd stop and he'd get a six pack of beer or whatever and we'd drive a bit and I'd say, "How was my match?" And he'd say, "Well, why don't you do this and do this and do this and do this?" So actually, I learned so much just by listening to those guys. But anyway, they would tell me all these stories and so I would put them, some of those stories in my blog. And then a couple more stories that I put in that actually happened directly to me. It was the Undertaker and I coming down Interstate 65 one night, right across, about ready to cross over the Tennessee line. And we were pulled over by the Kentucky State Highway Patrol at gunpoint and pulled out. I know the stories. Kane saved me from a bad riot that I started in Puerto Rico. He saved me from that. Another one was me giving Stone Cold Steve Austin his name in Memphis one night. And then again, we were stuck in this snowstorm or ice storm. It was a pretty good story. And it's not all about wrestling. It's just things that surround it. And then I got in a fight and I wrestled a bear and I did this and did that. And it's an Andy Kaufman story. And when I was in Memphis but that's the book. It's 272 pages and it's on Amazon.com. You can order it there. But what I do, if anybody wants an autographed copy of either one of my books, and I'll get to the second one in a minute, you can just email me at dirtydutchmantel with two L's at gmail.com, and I can get them an autographed copy. And I even pick up, ship it, and hand it myself.
Awesome.
So the second book was called Tales from a Dirt Road, and it's just a continuation of the first book. And it's a great read, and... Tell you what, I don't even actually want to know what, I can't even really give you any specific chapters right now, but I wrote both these books in about 10 months from each other. I wrote over 600 pages in two books in about 11 month span. because I sat down and I just started writing. I've always liked writing, but I never really called myself a writer. You know, it's like the book really reads like I'm talking to you now. It's almost like we're getting in a car. Of course, you drive because I don't drive much anyway. So you got to shuffle me around. But in return, I'll tell you stories. And Jim Cornette read the book, and even Steve Austin read the book. And a lot of people read the book, and they've either emailed me or called me and said, man, I enjoyed the book, great book. And it's almost like you're sitting there talking to me. And it's probably one of the only wrestling books, well, probably not the only one, but I don't call nobody an SOB, and nobody's an MF-er, and nobody screwed me here and jacked me around there and did this and did that. You know, it's the nature of the business that I chose to get in. And somebody asked me, well, do you think it'd turn out like this? Yeah. I mean, I'm not getting off subject here, but see, when I even got in this business, I never thought it was permanent anyway. I always thought it was a temporary business. Football, if you play professional football, it's a temporary business. Professional wrestling basically is a temporary business. A lot of things are temporary, especially when things are physical. Your body's not going to last forever. It's not like being a doctor or being a lawyer or being an auto mechanic or a truck driver. You can do that, you know, you can do that stuff till you drop over dead or get sued. A doctor, you lose all your money. But those things last a lifetime. Professional wrestling is a temporary business, and you have a window of time that you can make money in it, and you get in it, and when that window closes, and it will close for you. You don't necessarily close it yourself. It will close for you. And when that closes, hopefully you've done well in it, and you can move on.
Yeah, I like the wrestling books that do tell stories. I was just reviewing Road Warrior Animal's book. Goes in great detail out of his career, gives a lot of details of the matches and things that happened before the matches. And I know your book's a lot of stories in it. And, I mean, obviously as wrestling fans, we want stories to be told. I mean, that's what we watch wrestling for, is the story. So it's refreshing that, you know, as you said, there are books out there, or there's shoot interviews, or, you know, if you want that type of material, it's out there. But it's also refreshing to have a different viewpoint of telling stories of what you learned and where you came from and where you're going. And that, to me, as I said, is very refreshing. And I'm glad you're getting the feedback, because that was one of the questions I was going to ask you. What kind of feedback are you getting from your friends on the book, and what kind of feedback are you getting from the fans that have checked it out?
Well, it's really humbling for me to think that I can sit down at a keyboard and type some words on paper and put my feelings down and, like, detail what happened here, there, whatever. And people actually take that and read it and enjoy it. And plus, they paid for it. That's humbling to me. And it's on Amazon.com. And, you know, when you go on Amazon.com, I mean, that's a place where they sell books. That's a place for, like, Stephen King or, you know, the big authors. So to see my name there listed, you know, on the same site as Stephen King, you know, is, of course, I'm nowhere close to that guy, but it's really a good feeling. It really is. So when I check my reviews on Amazon, the first book has 16 reviews, the last I looked, and 15 of them were 5-star. Now, I didn't write that. They wrote that. And I got a 4-star from a guy in France. Now, wait a minute. What's a guy in France know about a wrestling book? So I'm discounting him. I'm just throwing him out. I mean, I'm invalidating his vote.
Oh, wrestling's international. Come on.
Oh, yeah. You know. And the second book, I don't know how many it's got. It's got like 10 or so, 12. I don't know. I can't remember now. But they're all 5-star. So the people that read the book have enjoyed it. And when I take it, when I actually go, I still make, you know, independent bookings and, you know, personal appearances. So when I take that book, I tell the people, I said, hey, my email address is in there, guys. And if you don't like the book, you know, send it back to me and I'll send you money back. And guess how many of them back? Zero. Because they enjoy the book.
Excellent.
And so if people want an autographed copy, like I said, you know, just email me at dirtydutchmantel@gmail.com. And the Mantel has two L's on it. And, I'll tell them how to get the book. They can order through PayPal, and I'll autograph it for them, personally autograph it, and send it to them.
Awesome. And I'm not
the only difference between me and Stephen King You know how many books Stephen King has sold? You see, no. Steve, talking to me, you don't not only learn about wrestling, it's like an educational experience to you. Actually, well, you'll learn more. You'll learn more from me in this interview than you probably will in the whole semester in the Tennessee public school system.
That's one of the reasons I have you on, you Dutch. I want to pick your brain because you've been everywhere. You've seen everything, and I mean, I could ask you a million questions here, but I'm going to try to limit it down to a regular interview.
The book is $35 signed, and shipping and handling. So
awesome.
If you ordered off Amazon, it's still $30 for shipping and handling because they charge you for that.
Right.
And but you don't get an autograph. So with me, you can just get it ordered directly from me at the same price. I'll sign it for you and ship it to you.
Now that you've written two books, are you going to write a third book?
I am going to write a third book. My third book is going to be called, and it may have a dual. This my third book may have a dual title. It could be Conversations with Idiots. That's a good one, I think. Or Wrestling Rulebook 101.
I like the first one better, but
yeah, I think that grabs you more. And I don't think I'll have any shortage of material in Conversations with Idiots, believe me. So, but I've enjoyed wrestling, been in it a long time, and in my first book I talk about how wrestling has changed so much from the early days. And when you really think about the life of the territorial systems, actually it wasn't that long.
Right.
If it started in the, I say it started kind of really getting around territorial-wise, maybe in the late 40s, 50s, and then it took off with the advent of TV, and then it ran strong to about 1985. So really, it was only like a 35-year run.
Talk a little bit about your Memphis days. I'm always interested in, it's one of the more famous regional territories back in the day. Jerry the King Lawler, of course, is feud with Andy Kaufman. I know you worked with Jerry. Maybe some. What are some of the memories that come to mind when you think back to Memphis? And I was curious. How do you think Memphis would do if it was a territory today? How do you think it would do in today's wrestling?
If it had to compete in today's market,
yeah,
it wouldn't do well. Let me explain to you.
Yeah,
Memphis has, and you can tell this, if you're a wrestling fan, now kids today don't know what I'm talking about. Kids today that watch wrestling, hell, if it's not WWE, they don't know anything about it. But through the beauty of YouTube, the YouTube technology, you can go back and you can look at some of those classic matches that Memphis had. But the beauty about it was that it withstands the test of time. It was good then, and watching it back, it's still good today.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Memphis, at one time, was probably the best wrestling territory in the country, bar none. And they were some good ones, too. Mid-South with Watts were a great wrestling territory. And Florida, under Eddie Graham, a great wrestling territory. Mid-Atlantic, based in Charlotte, North Carolina, and had Virginia and the Carolinas and part of Tennessee. A great wrestling territory, and he's owned by Jim Crockett, then Jim Crockett Jr. But Memphis, I don't know what it was about the town, but it had a rich, rich wrestling history. And, of course, being on a VHF station for years, and, of course, that was way beyond, that was way years before cable. But they were on the, and we only had three stations in those days, and maybe and then when a UHF channel came along, wow, that was like really technologically advanced. But when you can sit down at home, and people used to set their watch by Memphis Wrestling. It came on 11 o'clock. It was a 90-minute show. It would come on 11 o'clock on Saturday morning, and it would go to 12:30. And people, I even had people tell me later, they'd say, hey, on Saturday morning I would tell people, don't call before wrestling starts. I don't want to be bothered. And people would set their watch by 11 o'clock in the morning. And Jerry Lawler, I'm proud of that guy. We got the same birthday, same day, same year.
Wow. Okay.
You know who else has the same birthday as I did? Justin Hall Bradshaw. John Lee.
Yeah.
November 29th.
Wow.
which is uncanny, to tell you the truth. But anyway,
it must be a lucky date.
Must be. But the Memphis territory, even going back and looking at it today on the YouTube videos, still entertaining, still good, still actually compelling TV. And the ratings in those days just were off the charts. You know, Memphis TV would do a 20 rating. Sometimes it'd do a 70 share of the viewing audience. That's almost like American Idol numbers today. See, we were rock stars in Memphis, and I swear to God, we didn't even know it. Everybody knew you, and you get stopped for speeding. Cop, you go, oh, Dodge. Man, I hope you kick Dream Machine's ass. I hope you do this, you do that, and, you know. And he said, listen, I'm going to write you a warning. Slow down, man, okay? And, hey, can I get your autograph for my wife and my kid? Okay, here you go. Boom. And slow down now. You know, and they'd leave. You won't get that today, buddy. Well, of course, things change. But we were stars then. And the Andy Kaufman thing, there's a thing in there's a big chapter in my first book about the Andy Kaufman thing with Lawler. And it was my take on it and how it came about. Because I remember riding to Louisville one day with Jerry Lawler on a Tuesday, and he was telling me, hey, you know Andy Kaufman? I said, yeah, I know Andy Kaufman. You know, I'm a big Saturday Night Live fan, so that's how I found out about him. And I didn't think he was particularly funny. And later on, actually, when I finally got to know Andy, he wasn't funny. But Andy never claimed to be a comedian. Andy claimed to be a sketch artist. And a sketch artist, their definition is you just got to get a reaction out of people. Well, hell, anybody can be a sketch artist. I could run up to you, Steve, in the store and punch you in the mouth. I'd get a reaction. So when I got arrested, I said, hey, it was a sketch. That's right. I just kind of get a reaction out of him.
Some people probably like you punching me, you know. You never know.
Oh, yeah. but Andy was not, he was just tremendous. He tried to actually go to, this is the old WWWF. You know, he tried to go there. He wanted to do it first. There, and I'm going to tell you another story in just a second. You see how I like it? You see what I do? I kind of put ahead, you know, what I'm going to say, so that keeps people listening. See that? A little ahead of the curve here, Steve. But he tried to go to Vince McMahon Sr. was still alive, and they turned him down, so he came to Memphis and did that. And here's a guy who's, I guess, around New York, Long Island, or wherever he's from. He's up from up there somewhere. And if you looked at him, and he was a perfect character for Memphis. He'd come in and he'd make fun of the South, and he'd talk with an accent. People literally hated Andy Kaufman. I've seen a lot of guys with heat, and I've had heat, but they hated me for different reasons. They hated Andy Kaufman because everybody thought they could whip his ass. He would call Memphis TV and he'd say, well, I tell you, man, Christine, to say. And I've seen wrestlers, really, who were from Memphis, they'd get mad. Oh, he would just burn them up. He'd say, well, yeah. He'd do that Southern accent. And people literally hated him. And, of course, he started out he had the intergender challenge that he would wrestle women, and any woman that could pin him in 5 minutes, so he'd give him $1,000, man. So I remember when he worked the big feud with Lawler, you know, he showed up there, and I look out there, and this is my book, I look out there, and I don't want to give my book away, but I'm going to tell the story. I look out there, and I look in the ring, and there's this 5'8" or 5'7", 160-pound guy with pasty white skin and pimples on his face with, like, long johns on, you know, and a pair of shorts and some tennis shoes. Now, later years, when the backyard wrestling started, that's how they wrestle. But here's a guy standing in the ring, and he is probably the most unlikely candidate to be in front of and the house was completely sold out. 12,000, maybe 13,000 people in the Mid-South Coliseum. And he was the most unlikely candidate of all to be in that ring. But the only thing that made him qualified was that he was responsible for those 12,000, 13,000 people showing up. That's what made him qualified. And I remember the time that he did the deal with when Lawler suplexed him and he carted him out. They hated him so bad, they were taking him out on the gurney. And I went to the ring. And I don't know if he was hurt or not, to tell you the truth. I didn't know. Because sometimes a guy would be hurt, you don't know. But those people, they were throwing things down on him from the second balcony. I mean, from the balcony. And cussing him to get the hell out of here and go back to New York. And but he had. But it was a magical time. And I actually found out later that, and he didn't make any money much. You know, they just paid his air ticket in there, paid his, you know, in his hotels, all they did, and maybe give him, I don't know, $300-$400, not a lot of money. But see, Andy Kaufman didn't do it for money. He did it for the love of wrestling. That's what he did it for. And when he died, when he finally passed away, they actually found the checks that were still in his closet that he'd never cashed. He just kept them just to look at. He kept the check.
Well, that'll be Snooki today. She'll probably just keep her check, right?
Do I know? Know what?
From Snooki from Jersey Shore, who just did the WrestleMania thing. She'll probably just keep her check, right?
Oh, yeah, she'll keep it. Oh, yeah. She'll just keep that thing. So. Well, I'll tell you what, she parlayed that thing into a big day. So,
yeah.
I can't follow for that. But anyway, Memphis was a great time. That's where I met Sting, and I met Ultimate Warrior there, and they came in there, and they were green as grass, and I actually gave them the name. They came in as Team USA, and I got them together one day, and I said, guys, listen, yeah, Team USA is, I don't know, it sounds like some kind of Olympic team, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We need to change your name. Well, what do you suggest? I said, and I had just seen that movie, this where you can steal stuff. I said, Blade, well, won't you be the Blade Runners? Oh, we like that. We translated it into Blade Runners. So they weren't there long, but they came in just long enough to get, you know, just a little bit of experience, and then they took off. So, and I helped them a little bit. I didn't help them a lot, but, you know. But when Steve Austin came in there, I was booking Memphis, and this is my book, too, and I ended up giving him his name, and I explained all that. Then the Undertaker came to there, and then Kane, Glenn Jacobs, actually, I brought him to Puerto Rico. But these were the days where the territorial systems were dying, and Memphis was probably one of the last of the last picture show, to tell you the truth. And there was nowhere to go. This was back at the end of the 80s or so, and it was all the other territories that already folded up shop, because when Vince McMahon started his territorial expansion, it was hard to compete with him. And I've said a lot of times, I think this, a lot of promoters, you know, they just, instead of fighting him, they just, we're not doing it, and they left. So.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about Memphis, because I think a lot of people today, kind of evident, we just did a tag team tournament. We had a lot of legendary teams, and some of them didn't do quite as well. And I think there's no question that there's a generation change with not only wrestling but wrestling fans. I think a lot of wrestling fans, they don't know a lot about some of the legends of the business. That's why I wanted to ask you about Memphis, because maybe some people out there who think, oh, I know Dutch Mantel, he's a booker for TNA, and then they don't realize that, you know, you were an accomplished wrestler. You came from Memphis. My first really memories of you as a wrestler was in the Crockett days when you were with Bobby Jaggers as the Kansas Jayhawks.
Mm-hmm.
You always whipping that whip and cutting great promos. And that's really my real first memories of you. So talk a little bit about, you know, after Memphis, where you went from there. As I remember, as I said, the Crockett days. And then obviously maybe some of the other wrestling fans will remember that you showed up in WWF at the time. As Uncle Zeb and managed the Harris Brothers and JBL at one time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's in my second book. My WWF run is the stories about my WWF tenure with the Blues Brothers, which are Ronnie and Don Harris.
Right.
And JBL, John Mayfield. Well, I went to Charlotte because now a war was beginning to happen, because I think Vince McMahon started his expansion in about 82, 83, something like that. I think his first WrestleMania was in, 84, 80, was it?
85, I think.
85, something like that.
Yeah, 85. So, March of 85,
And everybody in the business, we kind of knew that, hey, that it was going to come down to, we all knew, whether we admitted it or not, that the territorial system was not long to be alive. and you got the WWF or WCW, or you didn't really make any money. So, but before WCW came along, of course, it was Jim Crockett Promotions out of Charlotte.
Right.
And they tried to run national against Vince. And actually, things were good. Things were very good. Wrestling then was probably in the best shape it's been in since that time. And then I went into Crockett's and Crockett Promotions with Bobby Jacker, who was one of the Kansas Jayhawks.
Right.
And I stayed around there a year. But there was a lot of transitioning going on, and there was a lot of I don't know if I told you on that the people would get what I said, but wrestling was a temporary business. You know, so but the way the business used to work years ago, see, when I got in the business, I'll just lay it out here, they were 32 different companies you could work for. 32. Now there's two. And there's some debate over that, but if you really want to make big money, you got to go to WWE. That's the deal. So, but when I started, 32 different companies you could work for. And when it got down to two or three, you know, now it was back nut-cutting time, so things were changing. But anyway, I went into Crockett with Bobby Jagger, and things were good, and I stayed around there about a year, and I had a run with Ivan, the Koloffs, had a run with them, and had a run with the Midnight Express, and things were good. Things were very good.
Where's Bobby these days?
I think Bobby's living back in Kansas, and I saw Bobby not long ago. Went to a wrestling convention up in somewhere in New Jersey, and I think he's working with FEMA.
Okay,
that's what he's doing now, and he's doing good. So, and it'd be good to see him. It's been a long time since I saw Bobby. Great guy, great talker, very entertaining. You know, when you wrote with Bobby Jaggers, you know, the way I can talk and the way he can talk, it was more in a moment. And Bobby was a great talker and a great guy to be around, and, you know, I enjoyed being with him.
Then talk about going to WWF. Did you wrestle much in WWF before you became the manager?
No.
Okay, so were you brought in solely to be a manager at that time?
Yes, I was brought in solely to be a manager. And it's actually, it was almost an accident, to tell you the truth. You know, because, you know, Vince liked big guys, huge guys, you know, 300-pounders and, you know, jacked up guys, and that was never jacked up. I was like 6 foot and maybe 225. And, but by that time, by the time I actually went to WWF, I was actually past my wrestling, you know, my prime wrestling years. I could still wrestle, but I was actually past my prime wrestling years. And, so one day I used to call WWF when I really wanted to go. I used to call WWF about once a week. And just to say, is Vince in? And his secretary would also say, no, he's not in. Who's there? I said, well, is he Dutch? Dutch, I will tell him when he comes in. Okay, next week I call. Same thing. He's in. Who's there? Dutch Van Tell. Oh, hi, Dutch. Next week. Is Vince in? No, he's not in. Who's this, Dutch? Oh, hi, Dutch. You called last week, didn't you? It got to actually the point to where I would call. She knew my voice. And I
wow.
said, Vince, hi, Dutch, how are you? I'm good. How's the weather? I'd have a 5-minute conversation. And I don't remember her name, but she was just the sweetest. She was just the sweetest lady. And she
said, your foot in the door.
Yeah, she said, I will tell Vince when he comes in. I certainly will, Dutch. It's so good to talk to you. I don't remember her name. Joanne, I think. I don't know what her name. I can't remember her name now. But she's just the sweetest lady, and sometimes I knew what would happen when I called. He wouldn't be in, but, you know, I'd talk 5 minutes to Joanne or whatever her name was, and she'd just be nice, and I'd go on. So one day I was in, I'd gone to Puerto Rico, and I'd been down there for about a year, and every time I always went to Puerto Rico, I've been down there, I've actually booked it 3 times, 4 times, but every time I went to Puerto Rico, always got it up, always got it moving, always got it kicking ass. But after a while, it's 100 miles long, it's 35 miles wide. You get the what I call island fever, and you just want to leave. So, and I actually made a call, and I heard that Ron and Don Harris were going to WWF. I think Undertaker, you know, put a good word in for them, and they got in there. And Ron and Don, pretty good size. What was it, like 6'8", 6'9"?
Yeah.
But actually, I called him, asked him, J.J. Gettle was there, and I said, J.J., Dutch, honey down, Dutch, what are you all on about? Because I'd work with him and Jim Carter Promotions. I said, I got an idea for you. What you got? I said, listen, why don't you bring me in and let me manage Ron and Don Harris? Oh, well, okay, I'll think about that. Yeah, he said, okay, I like it. Let me run it by Vince. Hung the phone up, right? Now, I never thought I'd get a call back. I thought I'd just throw it out there, you know. And I think that day I called up Joanne. I said, is Vince in? No, he's not in. What, is J.J. Dillon in? Oh, yeah, he's in, Dutch. And she sent me right to him. Now, she may not have done that had I not had a relationship with her. But I actually got him on the phone that day and gave him the idea. And he called back in about 30 minutes, and he says, Vince loves it. He said, we want to start you here. Boom, I'm in. Just like that. After calling for years, I don't know, it was probably 5 years. After calling all that time, I make a little call, and they okay and justify it in 30 minutes. Boom, I'm in. So that is a lesson to anybody listening to this, that sometimes if you guys persevere and have persistence, sometimes they'll give you, they'll do something just to get you to shut up and go on. and I went in there, and that's in my second book, Tales from a Dirt Road. And I detailed the thing with me and Ron and Don, how that started and how that ended. And that didn't go on long, because we went to WrestleMania, and I tell this long story about almost breaking my ankle. That we did a deal in Times Square. We set a ring up in the middle of Times Square, and I remember that it was being carried on. It was in the New York area. It's being called carried on the live morning shows. And you know, with Times Square, I've heard that at any given time, there's almost every nationality in the world walking through that area of New York. It's possibly true, but anyway, we set this ring up, and you know, when you set a ring up, you know you're going to draw a crowd anyway. And I bet there was probably 2,000 people in that little area of that. You know where the big sign is in Times Square?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that big billboard, that big Titantron, or that big screen. That's where it was. The screen was right in the little triangle area. The ring was. And I remember, I don't know how many people was there, probably 2,000. And we drove up in a bus, and when it come time for me and Ron Don to go to the ring. And all we were going to do was I was going to get in the ring with Ron and Don, and we were going to cut an interview on Davey Boy Smith and Lex Luger. So I got a ring, and I cut the promo, and I saw the accent, and those New Yorkers, oh boy, they's all over me, and, you know, it's almost a perfect wrestling environment, you know, because you expect to get that from the crowd. If you don't get it from the crowd, you're in trouble. So I hit it with that southern accent, and you assholes, and this, that, and the other, whatever I said. I don't think that's cuss, because I'm on TV. And with any segment, you know, you got a certain amount of time. You got to get in. You got to get out. They said, okay, you got 2 minutes from this. You got to get in, get out. And you got to talk, and they got to talk. Okay, I got it. So finally, when they talked, they wrapped it up. They step out of the ring. Somehow, you know how sometimes the ring steps goes around the corner of the ring, right? It pushes you right up to the corner. They didn't do that. They didn't put it around the corner. They put it like in the middle of the apron. So when I stepped out, I had my glasses. I missed the whole ring step and went right down that hole, right in the middle.
Ooh.
Oh, my God. I almost broke my ankle. And those New Yorkers, oh, my God. They were all over, hey, you redneck. Oh, man. Yes, I am. Yeah, go back to Tennessee. And, you know, when you fall, you're embarrassed. I didn't know what to say to them. I didn't want to say no. I thought of. And the only one who really, I got back on the bus, oh, my ankle, I thought it was broke. And the only one who really asked me, was I okay? Who do you think even asked me that, was I okay? Ron and Don, they took off. They left me there. Actually, some fans and a referee pulled me out and walked me across the street to the bus. I don't know. And they were rolling. They thought it was the funniest thing they ever saw in their life. The only one who asked me, was I okay, was Mr. Pan. He did come and said, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm okay. But I really wasn't okay. But see, WrestleMania, this was like a Tuesday or a Wednesday or something. Maybe it might have been a Thursday. But see, WrestleMania was that Sunday. And I wanted to make the show. So if I broke my ankle, I'd be off the show. So I kind of kept it quiet that I was hurt. It actually did have a little bit of a hairline fracture, but I kept it quiet, so I wanted to make the show. But anyway, and then it ended up late layoff, and then that's when I got with Justin Hawk Bradshaw. And then after I had a 2-year contract with WWE, and then I was, they chose not to renew that and wished me well in my future endeavors, and I moved along.
And then, of course, you went to Puerto Rico, and you were a very successful booker down there, which I don't think a lot of people know about, because obviously here in the United States we don't get a chance to see Puerto Rico unless it's, on YouTube. So talk about your experiences there, and how did you become a full-time booker there?
Well, it's like anything else. It's almost out of necessity, to tell you the truth, because when you're, like I said, it's a physical sport, and your body's only going to hold up so much. So if you want to stay inside a certain industry, you got to find a different slot, a different position. So, in my case, I had studied under what I call the masters. I had studied under a guy named Eddie Graham, who was a tremendous booker in Florida for years, because he owned the company, but he knew what he was doing. And I also studied under a guy named Jerry Jarrett, who also knew what he was doing, and Bill Watts, who was tremendous. And then I watched even Dusty Rhodes, great booker. A lot of people give him a lot of grief about his Jim Crockett Promotions run, but hey, the guy was smart. He knew what to do and how to put it together. You see, I studied under those guys, and I've often said that your greatest baseball player, manager, your greatest baseball manager was never your greatest player. Because actually, your best baseball manager were actually second stringers, because they would stay in the dugout during the match, during the game, and watch the manager manage the team.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they learned to manage. So I watched all these bookers all these years, and I would ask a question: well, why do you do this, and why do you do that? And sometimes it's just rule of thumb, and certain things that unless you ask, you can't know. That's why I say that sometimes the wrestling business, the way it was before, it's a dying art. And you really don't see it in WWE today. You don't see it in TNA today, because they just changed so much. Because it will evolve, but it's almost evolved just a little too much. But when you think about the amount of TV that those companies put out, it's mind-boggling.
Yep.
Years ago, they put out an hour show. Here they're trying to put out a 2-hour show every week. And in WWE's case, they're putting out 2 on SmackDown, 2 on Raw. Then next, now they're doing Tough Enough. I mean, they're cranking out. They're cranking out TV.
Oversaturation.
And then I went to TNA. I went to Puerto Rico. I went there first in the early 80s, about then. Damn, that seems like 10,000 years ago. But Venice was so hot, I couldn't even walk down the street. Because I would go down there, and I was like the first American bad guy who went down there and really trashed people. I called them little greasy, slimy, sleazy little bastards. And, I would not drink Puerto Rican coffee. It was bad, because I'd only drink American coffee. And I thought everybody was supposed to speak English, and anybody didn't speak English, they ought to withhold their welfare checks. And the women were loose, and, they had babies at 15 years old, and it worked, because they literally hated me. I was telling the truth, because, it was things that they actually talked about. But see, I was down there, and this is in my first book, too. I went down there not to win votes. I went down there to sell wrestling tickets, and I did, because we set a record down there. It was in the summertime, and it's hot as hell anyway. We went outside in a baseball stadium 9 weeks in a row and had sellout crowds of 15,000 plus. 9 weeks in a row.
Wow.
It's never been done before, or hadn't been done before, and it's never been done since. But they would draw, on those big shows in Puerto Rico, they'd draw huge crowds. So, I took it as long as I could take that ass whipping they were giving me. I mean, it was brutal. You've heard of guys. Now, when you talk, I tell guys today, I run a wrestling school, too, called University of Dutch, and I'm running here in Tennessee. And But I tell my students, guys, this is how it was. And they look at me like, well, what the hell are you talking about? You know, when you talk about a riot and the fans actually trying to attack you, they look at you like, well, what, have you lost your mind? That doesn't happen. Well, I got news for them. It did happen. Because I fought my way back to that ring more times, and finally it got so hot, you know, we would have to get to the stadium. The show would start at 8:30. They would advertise 8:30. We would never start before 9 o'clock or 9:15. And it would, you just watch it till about 15,000 people. I'd just sit in the dugout and watch it. But we would have to get there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to get in. And they would be 2,000 lined up to get tickets in. That's how. And we couldn't leave after the shows. Now, not all of them, but during this hot run, this two-month run, people would wait for us. Sometimes I've left those stadiums at 2:30 in the morning because they'd sit out there and wait on you. And the cops would leave. Everybody would leave. They'd just stand and sit there. They'd wait on you, throw stuff at you. You know? I had a guy one time, he wrestled for me, and his name was Exotico. And he told me when he had a broken English. And they play baseball down there year round, so they got great arms in Puerto Rico. Went to the ring, you know, they just light me up with everything they could throw. That's when actually I started wearing a poncho. Anything to put a little bit of a layer between me and the fans was welcome. I had a big hat and I had a tag team belt, me and my partner, Cowboy Frank Lane, and I started wearing a poncho. Oh my God, I love that poncho. I would just put it up like, you know, Dracula putting the cape in front of his face. And off I'd go. So I had a kid tell me one day, he says, and you know, in broken English, and he said, Dad, I need to tell you something. I says, what? He said, when I was a kid, I used to come to your matches and I hated you. and I would bring a bucket of rocks with me every week and I would sell rocks to these fans for a nickel. I went, well, you son of a gun. Now I wonder, I knew they had a lot of ammunition. I was wondering where it came from. And he told me he was the one who supplied them. But anyway, it was actually, I made very, very good money in my first run in Puerto Rico. Excellent. But I earned every dime. Now, you've heard of guys, and like I was saying before, you know, you tell people about really having riots. You know, you don't have riots today. Well, then you did. But sometimes I fought back to the ring. But on several occasions, I have actually fought to the ring and then back again. Now, that's when you got heat. So, but really good run. And I went back later in the 90s. For Carlos Colon's and WWC, and did great business. And then they had another opposition group running there. It's called the IWA, and they were running, it was two companies. And just like anything else, they made me a good offer, and I jumped over to the IWA. And they had never seen ratings like that. It's not rocket science. It's just, you just tell a good story. And on Caldas' side, I'd have a 16 rating, 15 rating, 17 rating. I actually did an 18-1 one time. And wow. IWA, I jumped over there, and everybody laughed at me and said, I can't do it, I can't do that. And I jumped over there, and about 4 months, boom, I had it kicking butt again. And and I kept them strong for about, I don't know, I stayed in there 3 years, 4 years. And we'd do those big shows again, those 16,000, 15,000, 16,000 people shows, you know, unbelievable. And it's hard to believe that an independent company, even in 2003, 2004, would fill up a 16,000-seat stadium. And I wasn't bringing a lot of just out. I wasn't bringing huge names, super names. I'm just bringing guys I could afford. And I thought they were too expensive. but the story was just so good. You know, it was great. So, in those days, in Puerto Rico, it was almost like the Attitude Era for the WWF. That's how strong it was. And since that time, I've noticed that when wrestling gets hot, you get 92,000 wrestling promotions all wanting to run at one time. Now in Puerto Rico, I bet they got 20 different promotions all over that island that run all over the place. So, but see, success breeds more business, I guess. But everybody thinks they can do this till they get in it. And there's no saying in the wrestling business. I don't know if you ever heard this or not. You know how you make a small fortune in the wrestling business?
How's that?
start with a large one. That's an old, old saying in the wrestling profession. And then when I was there in Puerto Rico, I used to bring Jeff Jarrett down there, and he was thinking about opening up TNA, and you can tell when I first brought him down. But that was right when Vince had taken over WCW. And remember when WCW came on that Monday night, and all of a sudden there was Vince McMahon sitting there? He'd taken
yep.
it over? Well,
the famous Nitro, yeah.
And he fired Jeff Jarrett on air right there. He said, J-A-R-R-E-T-T-S, spell N-G-O-N-N-E, gone. I still remember he did that.
Yep.
But anyway, I remember Jeff was kind of, I always liked Jeff, and I knew him since he was a 14-year-old kid. And so I started bringing Jeff down there, and he would look out, and he would see those big houses, and he said, man, what's this guy doing here? And so then I guess that, and this is in my book, too, he says, I think I can do this in the States. So then he talked to me about starting a company. I thought he was nuts. I thought he was crazy, to be the truth. But, you know, I got a good deal. I came back home and, well, started here. I started in TNA. I live in Nashville. So that's where I lived all my time, basically. And I stayed with them for about 6 years, and then I'm off running again. So that's how the wrestling business works. But one of the things in TNA that I'm most proud of, I did start the Knockouts.
Right.
And really proud now of Awesome Kong, Kia, that she's going to WWE, because I think that girl, I saw it from day one. See, nobody knew who Awesome Kong was before I brought her TNA. And in my book, I detail that nobody wanted the girls. Nobody. Jeff didn't want them. Vince Russo didn't want them. Dixie Carter didn't want them. No, the only person that wanted them was me, and the only reason I got them through the door is I said, listen, guys, we're not marrying them. We're just dating them for a while. If they don't work out, we'll get rid of them.
Right.
That's the only way I got them in. I said, man, we're not. Remember my words, temporary, temporary. Everything's temporary. In wrestling, if it don't work, dump it and go to something else. But the thing was, I got the girls in the TNA, got them pretty serious. And they got Khan kicking ass, and they got over. And for about 2 years there before I left, they hung their hat on those Knockout ratings.
Absolutely. Highest rated segments almost every week on Impact.
Yeah, and because I was the only one producing them, me and Scott DeMore. So I would tell Scott, and he'd take them out there, and then I'd check on them, and we'd do this and this and this. I'd take out this, and we'd structure that. And so that's how I got them there. And but Awesome Kong, I actually talked to her about a couple weeks ago. She's going there, and I'm so proud of what she's done. And I think she will do awesome in the WWE. So
yeah, Gail
Kim is there. And Gail loves wrestling, and we just had her as a ballet. And I said, listen, Gail, if we decide this is before we started the Knockouts, I asked her one day, I said, if we start a girls' division, do you think it'll work? She said, hell yeah, I think it'll work. I said, okay. And she was the one who recommended Kong to me. And I said, I don't know who she is. She said, go on YouTube and watch her. When I went on YouTube and saw this woman, this Awesome Kong, I said, well, gotta have her. And I don't know why WWE, well, I know why WWE hadn't picked her up, because, you know, she don't look like a diva. But that didn't matter. I think now they're going to take this girl and they're going to get her over, and I think she's going to do very good. She's going to do great.
Now, I think you were still there when Gail Kim left, go back to WWE.
Yes, I was.
What was your thoughts then? I mean, that was obviously a big blow to the Knockouts division because she was a big, big part of that. What was your reaction to that? Were you kind of surprised that all happened? And obviously,
I was surprised because I didn't know she was leaving.
I mean, as we look at it now, I mean, they really.
You remember the last thing
years,
Gail did on there with her little sister?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Katie Kim.
Right. Yep.
That was the last thing I did with her. And I wouldn't have done that had I known she was leaving.
I mean, in 2 years, back with WWE, she's done, you know, virtually very little. I mean, they barely, rarely ever use her on television.
I think they'll do more with it now since Kong's there. I hope they will. But actually, I encouraged TNA to do what you got to do, keep Gail Kim. Because when you put a big investment in something, And we'd had a 2-year investment in Gail Kim up to that point, maybe even longer, maybe 3-year, I don't know. But I encouraged them. I said, do what you got to do to keep her. But they were just too far apart, and she didn't stay. And in charge of contracts, you know, I don't want to be – I could do that, but that wasn't my area of responsibility. And I've always believed stay in your area of responsibility, and you can encourage from the outside, but when you get into the brass tacks, let them do it. Whoever's in charge of that, let them do it. But it didn't get worked out. But still, it didn't kill the knockouts because I still had Kong.
Right.
And on Kong, all I did with Kong was use the Abdul the Butcher playbook. That's all I did. How, this is nothing new. But see, what I'm saying is, the way wrestling is now, the riders they have in it, they don't know the old tricks that we used to do.
Do you think WWE signed Gail Kim to kind of, you know, you had something successful there in TNA. They said, okay, we're going to spite you guys. We're going to take Gail Kim away from there. Because they really, as I said, in 2 years, they haven't done really done much with her. Do you think that was what they were doing? Or do you think they just had some plans for Gail that fell through? Or what do you think happened there?
Oh, I think they liked Gail because she's a tremendous talent. I really do. And Gail didn't want to go, tell you the truth. She loved TNA because she loved the vision I had for the Knockouts. Because, you know, you can only do so many pillow fights and panty deals and, you know, you can only do those little silly things so much. But see, you can wrestle forever. And that's what she wanted to do. So she actually loved my vision for the Knockouts. I actually wanted to stay. It was just a matter of dollars and cents. WWE said, hey, we'll bring you back and we'll pay you this. And I think she presented it to TNA. I don't know if she presented it or not. I don't know. But apparently they were either unwilling or unable to meet that other offer. So she left. And I can't blame her. I can't. But I still had Kong, and that's actually what I brought her in for, to be the centerpiece. They have built the Butcher playbook, and it worked. And now I'm glad to see that and I think, there's not a lot of crossover between TNA and WWE now, except for the known names. And Kong is the only one who really, who got accepted to WWE just, without a prior WWE commitment. See, Christian came, he went back, and Booker T came, and he went back, and Kevin Nash came, and he went back, and, but Kong's never been to WWE, and all they're judging Kong was what they saw in TNA, and they liked it. So, and I congratulate her for getting the deal.
What ultimately happened with you in TNA? I believe in about mid 2009, your relationship with them came to an end. What happened, and why are you no longer with TNA?
Well, the reason I'm no longer with TNA is because, like you said, it came to an end.
State the obvious there, right?
that's probably why I'm not there. Well, I don't want to go into that, in truth. I do have another book coming out, and I may go into a little more detail on it. And there's no hard feelings. Again, it's temporary. I think there was a little bit of a personality. It could even been a culture conflict. I don't know, to tell you the truth. But they wanted to take it in the same into another direction, I guess, is what they said. I said, okay. And I left, and they took it into another direction. And when I left, we were doing a 1.3. And now here it is almost 2 years later, and they're doing a 1.2. So I don't know. You tell me. But I still got friends in TNA, and I like everybody in TNA, but it was a business decision, but I didn't think it was a good one. I didn't think it benefited them. I don't think it benefited me. It damn sure didn't benefit me. Because I left Puerto Rico selling out to come work for the company, and then end up getting released.
What did you think when they hired Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff to be a part of the management team?
Well, I don't even know Bischoff, to tell you the truth. I met him one time. I don't even know him. And all I know about him is what I read about him and hear about him. Never sat down, I've never said more than, I met him one time years ago in Center Stage in Atlanta, and maybe had about two dozen words between us. I don't know, blah, 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 this, that, and the other. So I didn't know him. Hulk Hogan I knew when he first broke in, and of course everybody knows his success. But remember what I said earlier, the greatest baseball player was never your greatest manager. I think that may kind of relate to them. I think Hulk Hogan, of course, he just got to use his name recognition. And so I hope they pay, I'm sure they paid a lot of money for those two guys. And whether the return on investment warranted that salary, I don't know. The jury's still out on it. But I hope they do well. I hope all of them do well. But I don't know.
Now, it seems like the one constant with TNA, of course, we've been talking about the ratings have been pretty much in the same, 1.1, 1.2, that same range for so long. And one of the most consistent things they've had there, of course, is Vince Russo. And, of course, he seems to be like the ultimate heat magnet that, you know, some people want him gone. Some people, you know, it's amazing to me. I talk to people who think he's a genius. And then I talk to other people who just can't believe he's still there. And it seems like, if nothing else, one of the most consistent things you've had is that Vince Russo's been booking for so many years. And to me, I mean, a booker eventually runs out of ideas. So, is it possible maybe they're on to something, that maybe what they really need to do in TNA is maybe totally re-sweep the creative process and bring in some fresh faces?
Well, in the NFL, a coach is hired, correct?
Right.
And coaches end up getting what? Fired.
Fired.
And why do they get fired? They get fired because they're hired to have winning seasons, win their division, go to the playoffs, and go to Super Bowl. A lot of coaches, that's their ultimate goal. I've seen coaches fired with, a winning season. They get fired because they lose – they lose the faith of management. But, and that's why they're hired. But I think a wrestling booker is the same thing. A wrestling booker is just like a wrestler. They have a shelf life. They're good for X number of years. After those X number of years go by, they start rehashing. And it's almost a natural reaction. Back in the earlier days, you would see a booker, and he would go to a place, and immediately he would implement his style. If you were familiar with his work, you knew exactly what he was going to do. Now, the fans didn't, but to veteran wrestlers, they knew exactly what the guy was going to do. And a lot of times when those bookers come in, they were successful somewhere else. They were pretty successful where they were. Now, as far as Russo's concerned, I wish him a lot of success. But like I said, they're still on the 1-2, so I don't know. I hope they succeed. I hope they do great. I hope they sell out. But they got their problems, let me say that.
What did you – I don't know. It was maybe a year or so ago, there was talk that Vince Russo wanted to take another position in the company, wanted to get away from creative. He's talking about, like, moving his family – I believe he was in Colorado, moved his family to Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that would have been maybe the best thing to do is just kind of get him a different position in the company? Is he like a lifetime?
Well, if he was smart.
Is he TNA
was smart,
for life?
Let me tell you about a creative position, a book position. That's the heat position. When a territory is on fire or a company is on fire, it's never the creative writers, or as they call them now. It's almost like, you can't use the B word anymore, booker. Oh, don't use that. Oh, we don't have bookers. Oh, God. Right. No. We have writers. Well, to me, having writers is like having a football team having a writer on the sideline. You need a football guy to run a football team. Don't you?
That's what I would do if I owned a football team, for sure.
Well, if you had a football team, the Cleveland Browns, you gonna go hire the sports writer at the Cleveland Daily Press to coach the team? You're gonna go find a football. football coach who grew up in the football business, who knows players and knows plays and knows this and that and knows the other coaches. Hell, you're competing. It's the same thing with wrestling. You're competing. So you better, to me, you get a guy, and that, to me, it's not that hard. There's a lot of wrestlers very, very creative. Very creative. And you know how much I wrote when I was in Puerto Rico? Zero. I wrote nothing down. I would show up on Saturday night and I'd go out, this is how I work in Puerto Rico. It's hot as hell down there anyway. I'd walk in the building about 6 o'clock, you know, and they'd be the ring crew banging around. They would be about 200 or 300 or 400 people lined up at 6 o'clock. So I'd go in there, and I'd go and get me 2 beers, and I'd drink the beers, and I'd look out there, and I'd sit down at about 7 o'clock. And then when the place started filling up, then when I'd go to work. Because I would get my energy from listening to that crowd buzz. And when I would do something, you know, I would watch what I did and watch the reaction of the people. They told me what to do. I didn't tell them. Because people just don't get up and stand and yell and holler and scream and, you know, just act all emotional over nothing. That takes energy. So I would watch them, and when they would respond to a guy, I'd say, okay, I'll put him over here. I'm going to do something with him. And they would respond to this guy. I'm going to put him over there. Okay, I'm going to do something with him. And the ones they didn't respond to, I just let them drop down, and I let the cream rise. Very simple concept. I listened to the people. They told me what to do. It's almost like if you're playing in a band, all of a sudden you play this song, and people go nuts. Well, damn, you're going to play that song a lot. Because now your fan base, they're enjoying it the same way. But anyway, a coach, after he coaches a team for so long, he's got a limited shelf life. He's going to move along.
Yep.
And same thing with the booker, because they get burned out. Every booker gets burned out. Of course, they don't have bookers. Now they have writers. So what I'm thinking, you know, what you got now is a lot of wrestling writers who have they have writer's block. They didn't run about ears. They just have writer's block. So. But...
A couple more current topics, and then I'm going to let Dutch plug his school and plug his upcoming appearances. What was your thoughts when Sting decided to stay in TNA and not go to WWE?
I didn't have a lot of thoughts about that. I mean, it's a business decision. If he's happy at TNA, then he needs to be there. See, some guys are concerned about legacy. I don't even think he's concerned about legacy, to tell you the truth. I really don't. I think he would have made more money in WWE, but at the same time, he would have had to work more. You know, Sting in TNA has a very, very light schedule and makes very heavy money and more power to it. But if he'd have went to WWE, and see, WWE, they already own all the Sting footage anyway.
Right.
You know? And he would probably be good for like one big WrestleMania and one big send-off. And of course, Atlanta was, and I was down there doing WrestleMania week anyway. And Atlanta would have been a perfect opportunity for Vince for Sting to be showcased one last time. And it would have been great. But, and he made the decision to stay in TNA, so, he's a grown man. He can make his own decisions, and I'm happy for him. If he's happy, I'm happy. So,
what was your thoughts on just tying in with Sting there? Just had a match with Jeff Hardy where Jeff, you know, shows up to work not in any condition to wrestle, and yet they booked him or they put him out there in the match. And I know you've obviously been backstage many a times, and you've seen wrestlers in different conditions. What was your thoughts on, you know, TNA allowing him to go into the ring and at least try to compete?
Well, I've heard conflicting reports about it. But I think it was very embarrassing, to tell you the truth. You know, you got to go by a gorilla position, what they call the go position. You got to go by that to get to the ring. Now, whoever was at that go position, and this is what I hear, that he was fine all day long. And then he disappeared for a while, and I don't think anybody checked on him, so that when they went to get him, they found him in that condition. So to me, when you find someone in that condition, and I can't say what I would have done in that, because it was, if he just showed up at the go position, all of a sudden you gotta make boom, boom, you gotta make a quick decision, I don't know whether I'd have done it any differently. I think they actually did the best they could with it, but I don't know why they made it go to the ring, to tell you the truth. It wasn't a good day to be a wrestling fan, and certainly not a good day to be a TNA fan that day, because that was uncalled for, highly unprofessional, and
I'm not going to
slam anybody. You know, it's one of those things that happened. It happened. But Jeff Hardy, I think he needs to get his act straightened out big time, because you know we've had too many tragedies in this business to begin with. And you know, to see that live, tough to take.
And then same way, you know, with Scott Hall, we've seen the same thing. I know you worked with him before, and we just saw him.
That's in my second book too.
Okay.
Big, great Scott Hall story. I love Scott Hall. I love all these guys.
I think we all do, and we all just want the best for the guy.
But Scott, from what I'm reading now, and he's had his demons. That's been well documented. Jeff Hardy's had his demons. It's been well documented.
Sure.
But what I'm reading is he was taking all kind of different medications. Well, that to me means that he's not going to the same doctor. Who knows how many doctors he's going to? And if he was taking all these medications and they're conflicting with each other, now why did they let him go to the ring?
That's like $1 million. When I saw that, I thought, who? You know, we got reports that he was messed up the whole day, that he didn't know where he was. He thought he was in the UK at one point. That he couldn't stand up for. He couldn't. I guess when he was signing autographs, he was making like a blank line. He wasn't even signing his name. And it's like, if you know he's in that condition, and I know the promoter probably pays a lot of money.
Yeah.
He's doing an internet pay per view, but at the same time, what do you get by putting Scott Hall out there in that situation? You gain nothing from it.
I feel sorry for the promoter. Yeah. Now, I also read that Scott Hall has a heart condition. Well, wait a minute. If he's got a heart condition, he don't need to be in the ring.
True.
Right?
Because
that's got liability written all over it.
Yep.
You know? So, anyway, hey, I wasn't there. It wasn't me. I don't know what to say. I can say here, I can say a lot of things. Like, oh, God damn it, this, that, and that, and that, you know? But it's not going to do any good. It happened. So now the challenge is not how it's how you react to it, you know, because I hate it happened, but me personally, it's not going to affect my life one way or the other. I hate to see it, but I hate to see it because of them. I hate to see it because of Jeff, and I'm not a really close friend of Jeff. He's an associate, and he was always good to me. He always treated me well. Scott Hall, I love him to death, always treated me good, and I hate to see this this particular phase in their lives, and they need to get it straightened out.
But
the people the closest to them can't help them. You know, hell, I'm from a distance. You are too. Everybody else is too. All we can do is sit back and say, you know, God bless you guys, man. Straighten it out, please.
Now, a place where you are is, of course, your wrestling school. Tell us about your wrestling school, and I also wanted to ask you, you mentioned it on Twitter a few days ago, I think, one of your former students is now on the Tough Enough show.
Yeah, Jeremiah Riggs, former MMA guy. And he came to my show. He didn't come a lot, but he came sometimes. And I could see right away, this guy, he had something. You know, and I was going to try to develop what he had. But he was still actively doing MMA, so he... And I think he was like 3-0 at the time, and he took this fight, and he won. He said, okay, I'm going to start training. But I got one more coming up, and let me, I got to train for this, and then I'm going to come to you. Okay. And he won again. So then he went on like a winning streak of like, I don't know, 5 to 6 to 8 fights. He won them. And he had been on a couple of reality shows anyway, and he heard about Tough Enough, and he applied for it and got on it. Now, Jeremiah Riggs, he's from Mississippi, southern accent like me, and he's tough as nails. And I don't know who won Tough Enough. And nobody does. But if anybody's got a chance of winning it, I think it's going to be him, because I think that guy, he's kind of got something, to tell you the truth. So, but that's a guy that I think he may make some inroads in pro wrestling.
Tell us about your wrestling school and maybe some advice you have for maybe a youngster that is considering a career in professional wrestling.
Well, if you're going to learn to do this, you might as well learn to do it right. There's a lot of wrestlers, and I'll tell you how why I started wrestling school. Got a kid come to me one time, and he wanted me to train him. I said, I don't have no idea. I don't want to train anybody. I want to do a wrestling school. It's kind of expensive, and it's time-consuming more than anything else, but you get what you pay for, basically. So I said, you need to go find your school and have them train you. He said, well, I did find a school. Well, what happened? He said, nothing. I said, what do you mean nothing happened? He said, no. I paid them my money, and they didn't teach me anything, which kind of pissed me off because I hear so much of these wrestling schools. They just take a kid's money, but yet not only do they not show him anything, they don't know what to show him. Because they haven't been trained themselves. Hell, anybody can rent a building and put a ring in there. Before their art comes in, is how are you going to teach these kids how to do something with their career or how to even do it? But that's what it is. It's called University of Dutch, and it's in Lebanon, Tennessee, which is about 15-20 minutes from downtown Nashville. And I got a big 3,000 square foot facility with a little arena setting. It's almost like a theater setting, to tell you the truth. Great place to learn. And, I teach them, not only do I teach them to wrestle, I teach them everything that they need to know about professional wrestling. I teach them diplomacy. I teach them, I teach them presentation. I teach them how to do interviews. I teach them all this that most wrestling schools don't have a clue about teaching. They're not teaching. And it's about a year-long class, and if you can't learn wrestling under Dirty Dutch, then you ain't going to learn it. But I don't get guys in there, and I don't beat them up, and I don't torture them. I put wrestling schools, they go out there and make them jump off this, and almost kill themselves. I'm not in there to hurt them. I'm in there to teach them. People can't learn if they hurt, and they can't learn if they're tired. See? And that's the way I teach my class. And I got some students I think will do well, and Jeremiah, like I said, he was there for a while, and I think I just really motivated him so much that he went after this Tough Enough, this thing. Did you see Tough Enough last night?
I missed last night's show.
I did miss it. I'm going to catch it on the rerun. But I heard he did well, and I'm proud of him. So if anybody wants to go to the University of Dutch, drop me an email, dirtydutchmantel, with two L's, @gmail.com. Hey, did I mention I had two books yet?
I think you may have mentioned it, yes.
Okay. Well, I got two books out there, so. But, and I also got a website, DutchMantel2Ls.com.
And lastly, Dutch, plug your upcoming appearances.
Okay, May the 14th, Nashville, Tennessee. It's Fairgrounds Arena. It's a, it's another legend show. And we had the first legend show January the 29th. That was Jerry Locker and versus Bill Dundee and Oscar Rachel Ralph. And on this one, I'm actually not wrestling, but I'm helping promote it. And I got a big announcement to make that night. And it's Bobby is a Rock and Roll Express versus Midnight Express. They're going to be there. B.G. James is going to be there. And it's going to be a big night, May 14th, Nashville, Tennessee. And we did, on the 29th show, we did 1,700 people. We sold out the Nashville Fairgrounds. And I think that's what we'll do the same. Because Nashville's a great town for wrestling. We got the word out on it good, and we're trying to get the word out on it now. And we had people, actually in Nashville tonight, we had people from England, and they were from like four, maybe 20 states that all showed up. And Canada, and one guy from the UK, I may have said that. But they're from all over. And a great night, and been a long time since I saw that building sold out, and it was a good feeling. See, Nashville used to be one of the stops on the old Memphis, the Memphis days.
Right.
You go over there every Saturday night, jammed out, packed out, packed out, packed out. So it's got a rich, Nashville has a rich history. So just, but what I find out now is that when I go to these legend shows, a lot of 40-year-old guys show up, and guess who they show up? They show up with their 10-year-old kid, or their 12-year-old kid, or their 14-year-old kid. They show up with them. And they want to show the kid what they saw when they were growing up. And then people always come up to me and say, Dutch, I used to come here, blah, 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 and I'd see you. But what they're saying is it was such an enjoyable time of their lives that they want to relive it again. So, but see, wrestling years ago used to be really, really fun. Now, sometimes it's not so much fun, but it used to be fun.
Yeah, it used to be really fun, and nowadays sometimes
Well, that's how you make a small fortune in wrestling. You start with a large one. So.
Was it Bret Hart that says sometimes wrestling don't taste very good?
Mm. Oh, yeah. Well, it doesn't. It's like anything else, you know. Now, in my books, I tell good stories, but there were a lot of some bad stories, too. I talk about the Bruiser Brody thing in Puerto Rico. I talk about that. I talk about the Eddie Graham suicide in my second book because I was booking down there at the time. And, you know, they are some distasteful things, but there's some distasteful things in life, too. Everything can't be ha-ha, funny all the time. And wrestling is a great sport, and I wouldn't, you know, and I've been all over the world in it, enjoyed it. But there have been times when I kind of hated it, too. And any wrestler you talk to will tell you the same thing. Probably a lot of football players say, oh, the time in their life they hated it. But yet, hey, you got to keep going. You got to keep chopping wood. So that's what I'm doing.
Absolutely. And we do encourage you to check out Dutch's website and his blog. I always put up a link to his blogs when he writes a new blog. So definitely check that out and check out his appearances coming up, his wrestling school. So a lot going on. And, Dutch, we really appreciate the time today.
Well, I enjoyed it. And if you ever need me again to run my mouth, give me a call.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.